I just want to go back to the long-term challenges that Jared raised in his discussion and put it to Felicity and Chris. So Jared was making the point that we need to be conscious of strengthening the budget now in order to avoid having to make much more painful adjustments in the future. What do you think the key long-term risks to the budget are at the moment, and which things do we have to address first? So if you're going to do this in order of priority, how would you go about it? Let's start with this.
Well, I think for some time, you know, when we look at the longer term challenges, we think about health and about the ageing population. But I think now when we see some of the issues around intergenerational inequity, I think it really highlights that the budget is really not set up at the moment to address that long term funding. When we look at this taxation on seniors, we've seen through the last couple of decades, a number of measures taken that has really significantly reduced the level of taxation through the cut in taxation on superannuation, through tax offsets for seniors, through the franking credits. And so what we've seen now, and I think the Grattan Institute's estimated that the number of taxpayers, the seniors paying tax, fallen from 27% a couple of decades ago to 17%. So we all know, I think, that as we retire, that the working age population will help to support people in retirement. But at the moment, we don't seem to have that balance quite right. And so I think we really need to think about addressing those issues going forward. So because that, I think, is where there's going to be quite a significant gap.
Thanks.
Yeah, look, I'd agree, and I do think... I think I probably failed to turn that on. I wouldn't see that. Push the button. I'll try again. I'll go. Button is on the front. Now I'm operating. Yes, my battery's failing, and this is too. it's luckily I talk loud. It is a great report, right? You know, and this is.
Oh, hello world.
this is something that's really dear to my heart, and it is right to think of it as a national social contract. Right? We tax workers, we tax businesses, we spend it on the young and the old and the sick and the poor and defence forces and the like. But we've got the balance wrong in a bunch of ways, and it is what it is. We can't go back and change history. But all sorts of challenges. Felicity mentioned ageing. Felicity mentioned the intergenerational challenges that we've been worsening along the way. Couldn't agree more. And so there'll be a lot of pressures to spend more to address those. And where we've been too generous, of course, it's really hard to wind those back. Susan, I think you mentioned productivity and... the Nobel laureate said, productivity isn't everything, but it's almost everything. It's almost everything budgeting, too. It doesn't show up that way when Treasury does its scenarios, but that's because Treasury does them wrongly. And
there is a... Yeah, there goes the battery. And there is a risk. So worth noting that built into those intergenerational reports... Oh, that's right, I'll just talk about it. Thank you. The what could go wrong? So built into Treasury's assumptions, whether the budget ones across a four-year period, the intergenerational ones across decades, Treasury uses a longer-term average for productivity, you know, basically the key driver of our longer-term living standards. It uses a 30-year average, and you know, you've got to be sensible, all right, let's use something. Trouble is that productivity lifts for a few reasons. One of them is new technologies and the like, but the other is the courage of nations, of electorates, to do necessary reforms. And Jared and the great report, you know, went through a bunch of things, and we know more widely than the budget is a range of other reforms that we can. We just haven't been doing them. And Australia in particular was brave and did a bunch of reforms in the 80s and the 90s, and it showed up in great
productivity growth in the 90s. Wonderful. But if you're going to use a 30-year average for the future, that still includes the 1990s. Built into 4 years of budget estimates or 4 decades of intergenerational estimates is an underlying assumption that we will keep doing economic reforms at rates that we did in the past, or a proportion of the rates we've done. We haven't, right? And these things take time to have an impact. The challenges are large, and there is almost, as a society, I will admit to being a budget nerd, there is almost no challenge more important than getting our national social compact right. And we've messed up in a bunch of ways. Yes, the health and ageing costs, the intergenerational pressures we're storing up for ourselves, and the fact that productivity may not be there to support it.
Okay. There have been a number of false starts on tax reform, which we've already mentioned in this discussion, in different governments and over a series of years. What do you think has been the impact of the failure to seriously address tax reform? And do you think that there's much prospect of seeing this failure to reform improve over the next little while? Maybe you'd like to open on that one, Jared, since you've already made some comments on this.
So I think one thing to start with on tax reform is, I think that tax reform has become much more difficult because of just how complex the tax system is. And we saw that in 2013, there were 64 announced but unenacted tax measures, and the government had to work back through them and talk to stakeholders about which ones they would implement and which ones they wouldn't. So it's a big, complex machine. There's lots of pages of legislation in it, and it's really hard to unpick parts of that and change them. So I think the result of inaction is clearly that we have a more volatile tax base, both at the Commonwealth and the state level, than we otherwise would. And we also have an over-reliance on inefficient tax bases. I think that's pretty clear. The other thing that we're starting to see, and you'll probably see some more commentary on this, I think, in the coming year or so, is that there's some really nasty effective marginal tax rates when you look at the interaction between the tax and transfer system. So when people are coming back into work, there's withdrawal of payments, or they're working more, and their tax rate is going up at the same time. So I think that those things are going to become more and more apparent, and they're going to bite. I was asked this question in Melbourne as well about how do we get tax reform going again. And it's easy to say there should be a review. Well, we've had two reviews in the last decade. We had a very detailed review by Ken Henry, and we also had certainly started the Rethink Tax White Paper process. So I think we need to find new ways into this debate. And one of the ways that I think is this issue around addressing volatility in the tax bases, both at the Commonwealth and the state level, because I think the states have just as much interest in getting this one right. I also think, perhaps on an optimistic note, stronger budget positions tend to increase the appetite for tax reform. And I think we're already seeing that in terms of the stronger budget position. There has been a move towards personal income tax cuts, for example. So perhaps a little bit of optimism to leave people with on that one.
Look, I think Jared's covered that very well, and all the sorts of issues that I would bring up around the narrow tax base, things like, Jared mentioned the company tax base in his presentation, but also around the GST, around the narrowing of the base, consumption as a proportion of GDP is falling, the GST coverage as a proportion of consumption is falling. And this is where, over the years now, Australia's developed this tax system where we're a little bit out of kilter with best practice around the world, and we do have this over-reliance on income taxes and perhaps not enough reliance on consumption taxes and perhaps land taxes. So I think that these are sort of the broader issues that we need to look at. also, I think that there's been sort of a missed opportunity with tax reform in the way that it can enhance productivity. We touched on that earlier. But, you know, a well-designed tax system will encourage investment, it will encourage productivity-enhancing measures, and I think that's something we've been missing out on, and you can see that in our productivity numbers. And productivity, as Chris said, that is what it's all about. That is what is going to drive increases in living standards for everyone. And so I think that's the way that we should be thinking about the design of any sort of new tax system.
A couple of thoughts. Worth stepping back for a moment, because we've messed this up so badly that almost every public debate is a disaster. You know, Jared ended on a note of optimism, and I won't. but let me step back and explain. So when we talk about a national social compact, you know, every grouping, every community, every village, that compact has two parts, essentially, prosperity and fairness, sustainable prosperity and fairness. The size of the pie and how that pie is sliced up. Size of the pie, in effect, living standards and how it's sliced up, the sort of all in it together, you know, who gets the size of the share. When you think of the two big levers in a national social compact, taxes and spending, people don't understand what each of those two are good at. Now, this is a massive generalisation, but I specialise in them. If you want to achieve fairness, if you want to do better around fairness in Australia, you're almost certainly going to be using the spending side of the budget. It's how you can most directly fix fairness for cheapest cost, if you like. If you want to be part of prosperity, and it's not, Felicity's entirely right, that better taxes hurt the economy less, right, can make us more prosperous into the future. It's not the only thing, right? Right? So we mentioned new technologies outside the direct role of government. There's cities policies, which are vital in Australia. There's federal-state relations, there's competition policy, there's a whole bunch of levers. Tax policy is an important one. We have done sensible things in times past. But two quick examples. You know, so you think of one way of making our tax system more efficient would indeed be have a higher GST as part of a mix. Other things equal, well, it's an unfair thing. It hits relatively more poor people, but you can adjust that on the spending side of the budget. And if people say, if they just look at a bit of a reform program and say you can't do this because of that, rather than the whole picture, then it absolutely gets missed. The complexities, right? I'm incredibly old and I'm still learning heaps about the tax system and the complexities of tax reform. And I've changed my mind on a bunch of, you know, so 15 years ago, a well-known organisation was trying to convince us to write reports in favour of cutting the company tax rate. And I said no, that there wasn't a good case for it. Subsequently, things have changed. Policies have changed here. Policies have changed in the US, notably company tax rates have come down there. The data and our ability to model this is better. And to be fair, this is startlingly complicated. But it does not stop people who have almost no knowledge of tax policy and its complexity saying stuff, right? So you think of something, I was about to say, as simple as our dividend imputation policy. You know, so people say, all right, well, if you cut company tax rate, most of that benefit is going to go to foreigners. And the implication is, well, it must be a dumb policy, right? As opposed to, well, yes, and that's a key thing that would actually make it work better.
when we're talking about prosperity. Now, we generate prosperity with our minds, our training, our skills, our expertise, our studies, but also the stuff we work with, the roads and the offices and the rest of it. And if our tax rate on capital is lower, we can bring more capital here, which makes labour the scarcer resource in relative terms with wages go up. To be fair, this stuff is stunningly complex, but it is so easy to derail any sensible attempt. Last one, swap it. The single best tax reform you can do in Australia is getting rid of stamp duties and replacing them with land taxes. I've begged, I've explained, I've PowerPoint presentations, I've done pretty much everything with state politicians in Australia. And they sit back and they think, well, this tax might, you know, in 10 or 20 years' time, make us more prosperous state and nation. In the meantime, though, it means I'm going from a lot of tax paid occasionally by some people to a still pretty solid amount of tax paid every year by lots of people. Thank you and goodbye as I get pushed out the door. It's tough and it's not going to be easy.
It's very interesting. I think that all the discussion highlights what could potentially be called a blind spot in Australia's taxation, finishing where you did, Chris, which is the fact that we don't really talk about wealth taxes really at all. And it's interesting to discuss the shrinking capacity of our consumption taxes and the increasing unfairness of our income taxes and the increasing volatility of our capital income taxes. But we don't really want to venture into that difficult space of wealth. Anyway, we'll move on. Let's move on and discuss the social compact, which has actually come up quite a bit in the comments that you've made. Do you think that there's a point at which the intergenerational pressures will actually force us to fund, will create a real crunch in the social compact that we're operating under at the moment? Are we just kicking the can down the road with incremental changes? Is there a tsunami on the way? Not the ageing tsunami, but related to the ageing tsunami. Is there a crunch ahead of us, or are we actually on the right track from a policy perspective? Yeah, we'll start with you, Jared.
Well, I think Chris touched on the issue around the assumption of on labour productivity in the intergenerational report, and also the growth assumption in the intergenerational report is 2.8%. So whatever you can do on the productivity side, and that's pretty much where the whole game is played in that long-term intergenerational sense, you get growth up, and a lot of these big challenges are actually less daunting. And that doesn't mean that you don't need to do a number of other things, but it certainly buys you time, space, choices to address some of these issues. I do think that there is a place for incremental reform. You've got to have both. There are going to be some big bang moments, but we do need incremental change. We've seen things like the change in the age pension age, something which will gradually be enforced, and then it will have an impact over a very long period of time. So I don't feel like we've reached the crunch yet, but I do feel like we've had a very prosperous period in terms of economic growth and incomes, and that has helped us to keep some of these crunch points at bay.
So is it coming, Felicity?
Yeah, no, I would tend to agree with Jared that I think that we really do need to think about this and address this, but it doesn't seem like it is coming really quickly. I think, though, it is difficult to get reform through, that we've seen that over the past 10 or 15 years. So perhaps it will be a case that we do get more of this incremental reform. Things like, we'll probably get tax cuts, personal income tax cuts next week. That won't be a tax reform package, but it will go some way to addressing the issue that income taxes have really become really prohibitively high for consumers at a time when wage growth is very low. So I think those sorts of measures are going to be quite helpful. So it is, I think, important that we acknowledge the benefits of this incremental reform, and perhaps that's the best that we're going to be able to get through over the next few years, given this difficulty with broader reform. I think, though, more broadly, you know, we have to think about this. This is not quite a budget question, but this question about intergenerational inequity, and it's something that really, I think, is so important that we address. You know, we had the climate change protests last week and or the week before, and you know, one of the signs that was reported having someone having up was mess with my climate and we'll mess with your pension. I thought, but you know, this really highlights the issue that I think the younger generation are really starting to feel like their future is being robbed. And I think this is something that has to be addressed economically with, you know, things like the budget, but also with social policy as well.
Yeah, discussions around fairness.
I think that was a great line. And I, and so it's funny that our public debates often collapse over fairness. You know, as any change, well, you can see somebody's worse off, so you can't do it. And across the period where we've been so focused on fairness, of course, it's become rather worse. It's become worse for a range of things, but it's become worse, well, it's deliberate policy. You've seen a series of policy changes that have been friendly to older Australians and less deliberately so, but in some cases unfriendly to younger Australians. That's just in the, you know, the day-to-day policies. You add atop that the fact that the most prosperous generation Australia's ever seen, over the last decade, where we substantially outperformed the rest of the rich world, we ran a big deficit. You know, it's not my problem, though the whole thing about the pension, you know, maybe there's more payback there than you'd otherwise think. We've truly messed up and intergenerational compact. Now, of course it was going to happen, because young Australians think all politicians are idiots, and so they're not engaged in the political process. Two things. All politicians are idiots, and they're not idiotic enough to, you know, they will absolutely be sensible to see, well, those people aren't even watching, or be nice to the people who are watching, older Australians, and not so nice to the younger ones. It is getting worse, right? And we've set ourselves up for a fall. Australia's economy, as a nation, we went from a China boom to a house price boom, kind of deliberately. We cut interest rates and away it ripped. Marvellously for us, across the period in which the housing boom finally ran out, you saw China's slowdown become large enough that it's been pumping out stimulus. In China, most of its stimulus comes through the construction sector, which means steel, which means Australian coal and iron ore. So we're now in this weird phase where the federal budget, you know, sort of the economy's getting worse, right? So Sydney, you know, the elements like housing prices are doing badly. The economy is getting worse, but the budget is getting better, partly because China is looking worse, and China's slowdown is leading to that. As you go from this, you know, sort of a China-driven boom to which is company profits and hence company taxes and so on, to a house price boom, which is stamp duties, and like we've gone from, you know, booms in federal revenues to booms in stamp revenues to a more even picture at the moment. But every time someone get the 5 minutes of budgetary sunshine, they make longer-term promises. Now, you know, everybody's mentioned this. The tax cuts that have already been announced and the first stage is delivered, though not actually in people's pockets until refunds arrive in sort of July and August. You take all three stages together, they're not unfair. They don't actually change relative burdens across, but they are too big. Now, the budget is better because China is worse, and that can last. Richardson family favourite saying, the unsustainable can last longer than you think, but
China's got 50 million, 65 million, estimates differ, empty apartments, speculatively built. We are resting our national social compact on something that's pretty flimsy at the moment. And the way Treasury does its numbers, it forecasts 2 years, one finishes in a handful of months, then and then does these longer-term averages. It's not going to look at that sort of stuff. And it's not going to, and we know PIFA, right, the election gets called, Treasury and Finance get their one chance every 3 years to tell truth to the Australian public, and each time they fall, you know, they don't, we know they can be very fearless and frank in talking to the politicians, they're not fearless and frank in talking to us, which is why institutions like CEDA, and again, congratulations, do need to stand up.
Okay. So imagine that you have to be fearless and frank and decide that on one particular area where you'd actually like to see spending rise relative to other areas. Which one would you pick, Chris, and why?
You start because it's an embarrassment. We have a very high minimum wage. It's about to go higher. Our unemployment benefit as a proportion of our minimum wage is essentially lower than anywhere else in the world. If you're worried, maybe you're not, but Talkback Australia is worried that, you know, about dole lodges. Out of 750,000 people, there will be some dole lodges. But basically, the bulk of the story is we are cruel to the worst off in Australia, and the way we've set our policies, it gets worse tomorrow, worse still the year after, and the year after.
Felicity?
No, well, that is definitely an important one. I think, though, we do need to see more clever infrastructure programs. I think that needs to be well thought through infrastructure programs that, you know, we're going to continue to have quite strong population growth despite some of the news that we hear. And so that we need to fund that. And I think that the federal government really has not been doing that particularly well, but I think it's really important that we see the infrastructure policies really properly costed, you know, proper scrutiny over the benefits that those projects are going to bring. And we certainly don't want a situation where we see projects directed towards marginal seats.
Right, so we've got New Start, infrastructure, Jared.
So we're clearly on the record around the need to increase Newstart, and I think an increasing number of bodies are. So I won't double up on Newstart, but I do think there is a risk there also of increasing Newstart does not solve all the problems. So the issues around entrenched disadvantage and the particular challenges that 700,000 Australians face who are in that predicament requires a lot of service delivery reform, so it is a necessary first step, absolutely, but there's more to go. I would actually, this is going to be a very boring economist answer, but how about some incentive payments for reform, for microeconomic reform? And we've talked about the need for productivity reform. I think it would be great to see, you know, some payments the states, as we've managed to do in the past, and achieve some good outcomes from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All the economists in the room are not against at this point in incentive. So, just finally, as a last point for the panel, your report, Jared, I think interestingly focused quite heavily on the need for trust and transparency in the budget process. So, in the way that the government reports back to us on how things are going. So, you know, do you want to elaborate a little bit on that and why you've put so much emphasis on that trust and transparency process in this report?
Yeah, well, I think, and it's a shame that this hasn't been picked up more, because I think it's really important. And again, going back to this point of the long-term challenges and addressing those. So I think without that kind of transparency and frank, long-term published documents that tell you exactly where the budget is heading based on current estimates, it's very difficult to have an honest conversation at the political level, and it's much easier for people to get away with promising things that don't necessarily match with you know, particularly some of the risks that Chris has outlined in terms of growth and our revenue base. So I think that's incredibly important. And also I think, you know, I'm not a political analyst, but all the political analysis that I've seen over the last two state elections in New South Wales and Victoria, the outcome seems to have been everyone saying, well, this was because you had two states who delivered on what they said they would deliver on, and that built trust with the electorate. And certainly that was the analysis that was coming out of Victoria. I'm obviously less close to New South Wales. So governments do need to commit to greater transparency and scrutiny of finances. And then I think they actually have to deliver by addressing some of the identified weaknesses in there, at least making progress, and having a plan to maintain healthy budgets over time. And I think also using all of that to, again, be clear on trade-offs and be honest and upfront about, you know, what can and can't be delivered within fiscal constraints and the things that will fall off expenditure if we do something that the community is asking for.
Chris?
And again, I think it's a very good question. So the great currency of the future will not be Bitcoin. It'll be the great currency of the past and the present, trust. And it's a currency that's more valued than it's ever been. All around the world, it's in the survey evidence shows that people are trusting essentially everyone less. They're trusting politicians left less. They're also trusting experts less. Right? And so you believe what's on your Facebook or whatever else. It makes it incredibly hard. Other things equal, institutions and institutional structures need to rise to that challenge. All those studies, why the dictatorships the populist dictatorships in South America, the institutions have never been stronger. Now, Jared was talking about some of the things that institutions can do. You think about it in this type of a field, a relatively new institution like the Parliamentary Budget Office doing marvellous work, all good. But we need other institutions to be stepping up to build trust as well. CEDA is a great example. Academia is a great example. Deloitte is the world's largest professional services firm, and we are actively trying to be part of national debates, right? The world's conversation, Australia's conversation, needs our help as trust evaporates, and we all need to rise to this challenge. And it's going to be genuinely tough. Some concrete suggestions, and all great, but don't underestimate how much investment we need to put back into the truth tellers, the productivity commissions, and the like in Australia.
Mm. Listen, I'd have to agree with all of that. I mean, as Chris says, you know, the whole trust issue I think has really changed over the last 10 years or so with the rise of social media. But we have to meet that trust, and I think some of the suggestions from CEDA around the PBO, taking responsibility for the intergenerational report, and perhaps these sorts of organisations that are seen as independent, taking a stronger stance to, you know, outline what the issues are and what some of the solutions should be. And so I think that the work that CEDA has done over the last couple of years has really gone a long way to furthering that. But definitely I think we have a big challenge on our hands, and just harking back to the intergenerational issue, I think where you see that trust is, you know, very much lost in that younger generation, where they just see that they haven't been listened to.
I think it's really important, isn't it, to have gatherings like this where we have a group of people in the room who can conduct a civil conversation, not necessarily in agreement with each other, but generally well-informed and from a diverse range of opinions. So on that note, I'd like to invite everybody here to put questions to the panel. If you raise your hand, one of the helpers will bring a microphone to you. Could you please say your name and your company or who you represent before you make a question? And please ask a question and only one. Thank you.
Hi, Georgia Clark. I'm a journalist with Government News. This question is, well, firstly, actually, I want to say thank you so much for a fascinating discussion. Jared, this one is for you. So you're calling for the federal government to recommit to the intergovernmental agreement. I wanted to ask you firstly what you think that will do in terms of boosting fiscal transparency, so that piece that you were just talking about before, but then also really interested in hearing what impacts you think that will have for local governments. Obviously, councils at the moment are calling for indexation of financial assistance grants to 1 cent. So just curious about those two pieces.
Yeah, good question. So I think on the local governments, the impact is probably minimal. I haven't read every single one of those 76 agreements. There's quite a lot, and they have quite a lot of annexes, which I haven't gone through. So I think that's less clear. I think what it will do in terms of, you know, transparency and better value for money, and this will take time, is it's freeing up states to pursue innovation in some of these areas, and also not having to be constantly going back to the Commonwealth and having quite a prescriptive agreement for, in some cases, $10 million of expenditure. And you can just imagine some of the administrative requirements around some of these agreements and the reporting for what's quite a small amount of money. So I think that gives an opportunity for states to be able to, you know, structure a lot of those investments in a much better, more efficient way. I think there is still, you know, that lingering issue around vertical fiscal imbalance, and, you know, again, comes back to tax reform and some of the difficult sort of tax reform discussions that Chris has mentioned around stamp duty and things like that, because at the end of the day, it does seem that states need to have greater flexibility around their spending.
Thank you. Owen Hayford from PwC Legal. So my question is for each of Chris, Felicity and Jared. You spoke about the importance of productivity, not everything, but almost everything, and productivity reform. And we've spoken a lot today about tax reform. Putting tax reform to one side, what do you think we as voters should be agitating our politicians to embrace in terms of productivity reform?
Well, there are a number of things, and Jared actually did touch on that, but one of the things is education. I mean, we are a services economy now. This is where the growth will be. This is where we're coming from. So we need to invest in our human capital, and I think that's something that the government really hasn't done over the past few years in terms of tertiary education, the university sector, as well as vocational education. So that's something that's really been, I think, a missing part of the productivity story. And these things are a slow burn. We've had quite slow productivity for the last few years, and it will take a long time for that to improve. So that's definitely another area. And the other area that I touched on before was infrastructure spending, and that certainly is something that will help productivity in the longer term. And the Productivity Commission did their report last year, I can't remember the name of it. Shifting the Dial. And they did quite a big piece on cities and improving service delivery within cities and within the health sector as well. And that's where we really need to be focusing our productivity changes around that service sector, because that's really the area of the future.
Could I just, and again, a great question, right? Because ultimately this is our living standards. And if our living standards are rising at a better rate, then our conversations
around how we share those living standards become easier too. But we have to have the courage to do these changes. And you're 100% right. They're not just tax, right? There are all sorts of things. In cities, in federal state reform, in competition policy, the list goes on. And when we say list, right, it's not as though we don't know what to do. We just heard that marvellous Productivity Commission report essentially ignored by the government, shifting the dial. Now, with 26 key recommendations and around a range of things that we can do. Some of them hard, a bunch of them actually not that hard. Again, you think of, it's not just, I would agree on infrastructure, it's not just how we, building more though. It's pricing it better. Do we need to do like New York City's just done, the congestion charging around roads to start to use our road infrastructure a lot better? Do we need to do that time of day pricing around electricity so that when the kids get home from school at 3 o'clock and mum and dad aren't there, so the air conditioning goes on, there is a, you just kill kids. That's off the record. We have a set of tax, apologies to bring tax back in, but also transfer welfare policies that that beg little old ladies to live in four bedroom homes in the suburbs. Our largest infrastructure is our $7 trillion in housing, which we set rules around spectacularly badly. We can do better. And it's not, oh dear, we need to think how to do this. There have been lovely reports over time that have told us. What we're failing at is that Australia used to have the best national conversation in the world about what needed to be done. It was often off the back of a crisis, right? We screwed up and then we fixed up. A recession, we got better. There are lots of people who think that after 28 years without a recession, when Australia has a recession, one of the silver linings will be that we'll get better at addressing some of these challenges. To be honest, yet again, I'm the pessimist, I don't think so. We've gotten, oppositions have gotten much better at opposing and being populist, both sides, over the last 20 years. And the next time there's a recession, I fully expect whoever is opposition leader just to take all those cheap shots and ride into power, as you saw pretty much around the world in a global financial crisis, right? It's going to be hard, right? We need to rebuild the institutions, which rebuilds the transparency and the trust that can lift a national conversation at a time when those conversations are getting really hard. It's not that we don't know what to do. It's just that we're not doing
it. So I would put health and social services reform on that list. This is where all the jobs growth has been in the last little while. And there is clearly going to be a need for new technology, new processes in these sectors. I don't think it's sustainable that you'll continue to see this level of growth in jobs without that investment coming in behind it. There's also just so many opportunities in health, an area where there's very little transparency for consumers, very little transparency about the performance of the system and the ability to then, make changes which will actually lead to better health outcomes. So I think if you look at that earlier work that CEDA's done last year on community sentiment on economic development, health is right up there. So clearly it's an issue which connects with the electorate and the electorate cares about. And I think if you can, talk about it in a way that is both about making this more efficient but a better customer experience, that's really important. And there's, preventative health. We spend about $7,000 per person in this country on health. We spend about $89 per person on preventative health. So there's so many opportunities for us to get ahead of particular issues in that sector. So that's probably the one that I would nominate.
Hi, my name's Ivan Kay from BSI. Your comments, Chris, on spending and tax and the dials were amazing. The questions that we're talking about: innovation, immigration, infrastructure, and education. in 30 years' time, we're not going to get income-driven economy, and we're also not going to have to rely on income coming in from the four banks and the two miners. It's going to be renewables and service. So what's happening is we're still relying on income in the tax reform. There's really no tax reform. Is it going to be in 30 years' time a totally consumption-driven tax? And if so, how are we going to move from being income-focused to consumption-focused? Is that the goal? Is that the goal?
And there are only a handful of basic tax bases to tax. And despite there essentially being only four, Australia still manages to have more than 130 taxes and to get the mix of it wrong in a variety of ways. One of the ways that we've got it wrong is too great a reliance on income taxes and not enough reliance on indirect taxes, but also a range of, wealth is a great example. We will have to change. The underlying nature of the economy, China's maturity will mean that some of the excess profits they've made in coal and iron ore and whatever else, they will disappear away. Chances are that a combination of new technologies, competitive entry, and angry bank ventures will mean that the profits of the big four banks, or indeed the financial services sector more generally in Australia, will be smaller. Absolutely, we'll need to address those. Our experience increasingly over the last 20 years, though, is that we're not being good at handling those structural changes. We're not being good at handling the debates. One little example, immigration. Incredibly complex, all sorts of things to be talked about. One, migrants don't steal jobs. So unlike Talkback Australia or Barbecue Australia thinks, migrants don't, it's very tempting to think that migrants steal jobs. I was going for that, my friend was going somewhere. But Australia's had this debate about terrible people stealing jobs in the 1970s. Or married women, were coming in, they were stealing jobs, right? And the point is that if a migrant or a married woman or a Martian puts up their hand to take a job, to steal a job, they earn an income and they spend it, which creates the next. Nobody's stealing a job. And our basic national conversation around migration is bad. On the other hand, because Australia, 25 million people in a continent of opportunity at a time of global development, that means we have what the world wants. A good migration program can raise living standards per head here. But in the last decade, average population growth in Tasmania was faster than that in Germany and France. In South Australia, it was faster than UK and US. You have to have the infrastructure. And we failed for so long around infrastructure that our migration debate has become even worse still, because it's a failed infrastructure debate and we're not treating it as such.
We have one more question down the back. Unfortunately, this will be our last.
Oh, but I'm wasted then. It's Brian Parker from SunSuper. A question to the panel, but I think it's based on a comment that Felicity made about, if you compare us to world's best practice in tax, out of the, let's say, the significant countries or economies of the world, who would you rate as world's best practice in tax policy and why?
And you have to keep it short.
I did make that comment. I don't think that I am an expert enough in international tax arrangements to actually highlight one particular economy that has it right, but Chris probably has a bit more expertise.
So for a long time, the US was a first world country with a third world tax system. Its tax system has improved. For years, New Zealand led the world, but it's dropped off the curve. It's only now having discussions around capital gains taxes and the like. Britain's not bad. Scandinavia's not bad. And it's a good point, right? Australia could do much better, but the entire world could. And we're all failing because these conversations are difficult. And a conversation that a handful of years ago was difficult has now become really difficult.
we have to turn it around.
Which is a fine point on which to call this discussion to an end. Thank you very much. I'd really like you to join me in thanking our panellists.